Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. History lies at the heart of every Steve Berry novel. The New York Times bestselling author returns today with his latest thriller, The 14th Colony. It's full of action, history, conspiracy, secrets, and it's all set against the backdrop of America's greatest stage. We'll also hear from geologist, journalist, and educator, National Geographic. He's a National Geographic program director, Ford Cochran. He's helping celebrate the 100th birthday of our national parks. Interesting story behind that, and we'll hear from Ford in about 25 minutes. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Megan Foy. She's an experienced magazine editor and has worked at 17 Magazine, Woman's Day, and Elle. She's the former senior web editor at RedBookMagazine.com, and she's the author of the new novel. It's called Meternity. Megan Foy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, and what a fun book. But, you know, what surprised me when I always like to look at how people review books, Megan, and yeah. People started out saying, well, you know, I expected this just to be fun, but it also made them think, and we'll find out why in a few minutes. But let's begin with the protagonist of your book, Liz Buckley. You say on your website, when you conceived the character of Liz, it was an almost fever frenzy when you were 31, newly single, burned out. And you also say about Liz Buckley, it's my deepest hope that you don't see yourself immediately in the character of Liz Buckley. She's strong-willed, funny, a little angry, a little sarcastic, a little stuck for reasons she's too quick to blame herself for. But most of all, she's very tired.
Yes.
a place I think many people can find themselves in when they've been chasing that career, and it just seems nonstop. So tell us a little bit about Maternity, about Liz Buckley, how you came up with the idea for the protagonist.
Yes, well, so I was actually 31 myself, and like Liz, I was a little bit burned out at my job. I had been working for about 10 years in the magazine industry, and it was one night at supper club with my three best friends, and they told me that on the same night that they were all going on maternity leave, they were all pregnant, and they were going to be taking maternity leave that summer. And I just thought to myself, I want a maternity leave. And we were laughing and we were thinking, like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if I faked being pregnant to get a maternity leave? And my friend said to me, you know what you need? You need a meternity leave where you get to just take a little time off. And I thought, that's genius. And so I went home and I immediately started to write. And I came up with this idea about a woman who fakes being pregnant to get some time off.
And the book, of course, is called Meternity, and who says you have to be pregnant to take maternity leave?
Yes.
So what kept you going with this story? I mean, it's interesting how stories come together. You're sitting there, as you said, at supper club with your friends, and this idea comes to you. And I think probably people who don't have children can relate to the fact that, yes, we'd like some meternity leave, even though we're not having a kid. And probably some moms, quite a few moms would like meternity without the kids too. But what kept you going with that idea and made it into a book?
Yeah, so as I started writing it, I started talking to all of my friends, many of whom were single, but also many of whom were mom, new moms. And they all kind of said to me, you know, I'm just tired. I've been working for 10 years. And I think we're in this interesting moment in time where with our smartphones, we're now tethered 24/7. And at the same time, you know, we're all taking on the jobs, or sometimes taking on two or three jobs. The assistant ranks have been decimated. So we just all are sort of a little bit burnt out and wondering, I just thinking I would love some time off. And I think that, you know, this character, I have her in the first scene start to look around her and think, well, there are some moms on staff who they do have a good excuse to leave at 5, whereas I'm single and I really don't. And I think that many single women might kind of feel that same way, where if it does come down to who can leave, it really does end up being the moms on staff who have the good excuse. So Liz decides to, kind of in a panic, hatch this plan.
Right. And you actually, you took your own maternity leave. I think it was in 2000 through 2012. You didn't fake the pregnancy bit though, right?
No. So I thought about it just for good research. No, but I actually did end up quitting my job and planning to take about a year off to actually work on this book, but carve out a freelance writing career as well. And I got to do some amazing travel and, yeah, just basically take a little bit of time off and regroup and take stock and figure out what I wanted to do next.
Right, right. So do you think, I mean, how much of this did you take from the workplace? How much is from your workplace, your work environment is in the book? Because, you know, I think if you haven't worked in publishing, people do not understand how grueling it is. It is constant churn. You get one edition out and you're already working on the previous one anyway, the next one anyway, but it's just constant churn, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I had, you know, I had been working for about 10 years in women's magazines, as you mentioned, and with, you know, each of the staff had about 30 women. So we're constantly in this churn and just, I'm amidst many different women and many different life stages. So I definitely drew from my experiences in the magazine world. But I also, you know, we're talking to all my friends and hearing their experiences and kind of getting a consensus, basically, about this very specific moment in women's lives.
Right, right. So Liz Buckley, your protagonist, she works at a baby magazine. Why a baby magazine?
Right. So it really did actually just come to me in that initial fever frenzy. But as I was writing, I just thought, wow, there is a lot to mine here. We're in this amazing moment, you know, where Kim Kardashian and Kate Middleton are both pregnant and giving birth. And we're kind of obsessed with every little life stage. And I think with women who are celebrities who are pregnant. And I think social media has really amped it up, too, because every day the news cycle follows their every little life stage. And when, you know, Chrissy Teigen puts out something on Instagram, the internet explodes. So I just really thought that would be fun to kind of to make fun of a little bit. And then also just, you know, an obsession with doing it with all moms kind of wanting to do it right. And right. We can all get a little bit crazy, especially when we're comparing ourselves against these idealized images that we see on social media from our friends who are moms every day.
Oh, for sure. Now, she's wearing this fake baby bump at day and feigning, you know, backache and headache and drinking decaf. But at night, she's going out and she's partying. She's really leading a dual life. Why did you choose to do it that way than keep the pretense up all the way through?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that also comes a little bit from experiences living in New York City. I think if you're single, really, there's no other choice. You got to go out, you know, to meet your friends at happy hour. But I think, too, I just wanted to keep up that dramatic tension and make it and make her. I mean, she's not just going out to blow off steam. She's really going out to meet up with her friends and help figure out next steps. Or she's going out to meet a potential love interest who she has really, you know, legitimate feelings for. So she's caught between wanting to move forward with her life in that sense, but with the lie that she's also found herself in.
Right. And then it gets even more complicated when she actually has some flirtation as a single girl, a single flat-tummied girl by night, right?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. So at the beginning, she's very burned out, receiving no love from her litany of online dates that she's been attempting to try to, as I say, find the unicorn of Tinder. She hasn't had no luck whatsoever. But then as she starts faking this bump and getting a little bit more success at work, she starts to get her confidence back. And with that, you know, when you get your confidence back, you tend to draw more people in. So she's working with this partner at the Discovery Channel, Ryan, and he starts calling her and wanting to see her. And then she really starts to fall for him. But then it becomes very difficult because he can't come to the office and meet up with her. So she has to keep that ruse going as well.
So you just mentioned Tinder. Vanity Fair did a great article on this last year because I knew Tinder was a dating app, but I didn't really know too much about it until I read the Vanity Fair article. So share a little bit about that, you know, because it's very important to that age generation, or at least it seems it in the big cities. I've asked a few people, are you on Tinder? And they've gone, heck no, but...
Yeah, Tinder, you know, I think it's just a huge part of the dating scene, I think, especially, you know, for millennial women and women living in New York City in the past year or so. I think everybody is sort of the guilty little secret. Maybe everybody's on it and they don't really want to go on, or for women, maybe they don't really want to go on it, but at the same time, it's there and it's happening. So, yeah, I read that Vanity Fair article too, and it was so depressing. But I think that, you know, as a woman, especially if you just go on it for the first time, it can really easily spiral into this kind of sad, take you into this sad place where you start to devalue, you know, your worth. And so I think it's not true for Liz that she couldn't find somebody great, but I think she's just gotten a little bit sucked into that perception at the moment, at the beginning.
Right. Because really, for those who don't know, Tinder is more of a hookup app than a dating app, per se, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's just, oh, I like the look of you. Let's right swipe you or left swipe you, whichever way they do it. And let's see if we can hook up tonight. And then they never meet again. But yeah, interesting.
So, I think people are using it all different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think with poor Liz, yeah, she might have thought it was a dating app, but didn't realize it was really just a hookup app.
So one of your reviewers, I'm going to just read this and then have you comment on it. She said, I thought this was going to be some silly, funny book, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to read it, this being prime vacation reading at the moment. But I really liked the description and thought a light, humorous read might be beneficial. The book turned out to be so much deeper and more meaningful than I expected. It's making her think, I'm assuming it's a female, making her think a lot about life and the choices that she's made because she chose not to have children and the things that women have to go through in the workplace. How does that make you feel when you hear something like that? Because I think that's a very positive review if you make somebody think that way.
Yeah, I mean, I was so happy to read that review. I felt like she got it. You know, it's really what I was trying to go for, because I think it is a lighthearted comedy, but at its heart, it's really opening up it's trying to get at the heart of the biggest life decision that pretty much every woman will make, you know, is when and if they'll have children. And I think that we all go through this in our own ways, and there's so many different ways that women are going about it now, you know, whether it's being a choice mom where they decide that they're going to go forward and have children on their own without a partner, or they do it the traditional way, or they decide to hold off, or they decide to put their career first for a little bit, or they decide to deprioritize their career. It's like career and this choice are connected for women in such a rife way that it can be really difficult, and it can put a lot of pressure on you. So I wanted to just take a moment to explore all of that pressure that women are feeling right now, and through this lighthearted idea.
Yes, and I actually just last year, one of my friends, she's in her late 30s. I mean, she's not old by any means. But she chose to have artificial insemination. She went to a sperm bank and she wanted a baby. And gosh, I have to tell you, I've never seen her look happier. She's still working, but there was no guy on the horizon. So she thought, let's go for it and do it now. So a lot of choices we have out there.
Yeah. And I just, as I was writing this book, I explored all of those themes. And I talked to so many women, and actually, you know, working at Redbook, I worked on a series about infertility and worked with this amazing blogger who was going through her fertility journey. And I just think, you know, women are so strong, and they're amazingly strong, and they're figuring it out. And I wanted to explore all of those themes and highlight the strength in this book too.
Right. Right. And you know, people have a wide range of choices, as we said, these days. But I watched a couple of documentaries where they say that women in Finland and Iceland are the happiest in the world because they don't do the marriage route. They still have babies with their chosen guy, and they still raise those babies with those chosen guys, but they don't go the marriage route. It's kind of interesting.
I find that fascinating, and I'm interested in exploring more about that. I've traveled to those countries, and it seems like it is connected to finances too, you know, because mm-hmm. their socialist systems and, you know, healthcare maybe more paid for and
yes.
education, and I think when you take that burden off, it allows you to make your major life choices a little bit differently.
Right, right.
So and not put so much pressure.
It's very true because they have fantastic medical care. They do pay higher taxes than we do, but in return, they're really well taken care of, very well taken care of. So this really is a story of self-discovery for Liz Buckley. What did you discover about yourself, Megan Foy, while you were writing this?
I think that this choice for me had been put on the back burner, to be totally honest. My feelings about babies I'd sort of pushed aside to make it in the fast-paced, cutthroat magazine industry. And in writing this book, honestly, it allowed me to really take stock for myself and figure out, you know, what I really wanted and, you know, and clarify that for myself so that once I knew, I could start prioritizing it.
Right. Do you want to share that with us?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I would like to have kids. I really, really would. All my friends now are moms. It's interesting. They weren't at the beginning when I was writing it, but now they are. So I've kind of since come around, you know, personally to the other side, to the arch nemesis side, the leaks, and really have seen it from both sides and really tried to depict that in the book as well. But yeah, no, I would love that. And so I've been busy writing, but I've been actively trying to make that happen for myself as well. But
right.
I think in figuring that out, it was like a great first step.
Right. And so you're freelancing now. What does a typical day look like for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the book actually comes out tomorrow. So I have been doing a lot of, you know, behind the scenes stuff, working to promote it. And I'm hoping to launch meternity.com this summer, which is going to be a space online and on Facebook for women to share, to get ideas and inspiration on how they can take a meternity themselves. So I'm hoping to do a meternity of the week where we have one brave woman story who managed to take some time off. And I'm calling it like a self-led sojourn, where it's like a little bit of time off to let your intuition bubble up again and help you figure out exactly what it is you want to do.
Right. I think meternity is a great idea for all you corporate people listening out there. I think it's something I think we'd all be a lot better off if we could take time off to, you know, just it's very hard to figure out what you want and where you want to be and what direction you want to go in and, you know, the changes you want to make when you're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. And, you know, I think that's an awesome idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difficulty is the finances part, right? That's
yeah.
the part I think we're all facing. And, you know, I worked in the magazine industry. It's very low paying. But I think that for a few years, I was sort of just stocking aside part of my paycheck the way that they tell you to, where you don't even see it. And I did actively try to budget myself so that I was able to kind of cut back so that I could have a little bit of money. But yeah, it was once I still went and did it, it was pretty scary and the money was tight and it was, you know, it was a risk for sure. So I totally get that for people, it's not always easy. But what I kind of tell them is, okay, so you don't have to take time off, but maybe you can arrange for a slightly longer vacation schedule, you know, 1 year or take even just a solo weekend. But the trick is just try to do something that's completely diametrically opposite from your work life.
Yes.
Because that work life can be so structured and scheduled that what you really just need is some time where it's unstructured and unscheduled and sort of mimicking the idea of maternity where your body does sort of take over and lead the way. This is sort of the same idea. It's like let your body, you know, your intuition, your intuitive mind take over and lead the way and just see what comes up. That might be kind of more interesting than you think.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. I love that idea. The book is called Meternity. It does come out tomorrow. My guest is Megan Foy. And Christine Hamel said, if Bridget Jones had a modern-day BFF who worked at a New York magazine, was faking a pregnancy, and was struggling with post-30s singledom, this laugh out loud book would be her book. So final, very, very quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Megan.
I hope you guys all enjoy the book, and I hope you laugh out loud, but also just take heart that, you know, about the themes that we talked about.
Yeah, and remember, we're all at choice here. We're all at choice.
Yeah.
And you can find out more about Megan and her work at meganfoy.com. And Megan is MEGHANNFOYE, meganfoy.com. Megan, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
And please do stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, best-selling author Kristen Woodson Harvey's new book, Lies and Other Acts of Love, explores the lies we tell to protect our loved ones and the life-altering consequences of a hidden truth revealed. Plus, New York Times investigative journalist looks into the science, psychology, and emotional truth behind creativity and being the best we can be in smarter, faster, better. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. National Geographic launched a year-long exploration of America's power parks in celebration of the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. So last week, I spoke with Ford Cochran. He's a geologist, journalist, educator, and the director of programming for National Geographic Expeditions. That means he's the person who selects the expert scholars, writers, photographers, and explorers that National Geographic sends on its educational expeditions around the world. His work has earned multiple Webby, Cody, and People's Voice Awards. It's also won the American Association of Museums Muse Gold Award. And as I said, right now, he's involved with celebrating the 100th birthday of our National Park Service. So we sat down last week to talk a little bit about what he does and a little bit about the books, which are just stunning. So we're going to bring that interview to you right now. Ford Cochran.
I've had this great privilege of working for National Geographic now for almost a quarter of a century. But what I have done over the last several years is work as the director of programming for our educational travel group, National Geographic Expeditions. We take travelers around the world. We take them to places including many of our national parks, and always have an expert scholar, photographer, writer, adventurer, explorer, or staff member join those trips. And I've been on many of them myself, and then for the last half decade, have been the person who coordinates all those folks. So I get to work with pretty much everyone who's associated with Geographic Travels on our trips.
Wow. And those travelers you talk about, are they just regular people, regular members of the public?
They're regular members of the public. Many of them are families bringing their kids. We have student expeditions for middle school and high school students, teaching them filmmaking, photography, science, archaeology, all the sorts of things that Geographic does, wildlife biology. Photography enthusiasts travel with us, so we've really got something for everyone.
Wow. What a great trip. What a great opportunity for people. So these books that we're talking about today are A Guide to National Parks of the United States and, of course, The Kids Guide. And, you know, when I was looking through The Kids Guide, Ford, I thought, if I'd had these when I was a kid, I might have had a whole different life ahead of me. They are so well put together and they're so engaging. Now, I know that you didn't author these books, so tell us what your role was with these books.
I'll tell you, I'm a big, big fan, and I'm a user of these books. I'm a reader of them, and I'm someone who puts them to use. The kids guide, I have kids of my own. They're 16 and 14 now, but I've been taking them to the national park since they were both very young, both around where we live. In fact, when my oldest son, Cole, was just a few weeks old, the first thing we did after we left the hospital was take a trip to Colonial Williamsburg. We got to Yorktown and Jamestown, so we were visiting national park sites, historical sites, and then when he was 7 years old, I took him out to Yellowstone and Grand Tetons National Parks. We had a great adventure. We've been doing all kinds of traveling, both, you know, Shenandoah near where I live in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., and across the country. But also, we have an adult guide to parks. It's sort of really for everyone, the guide to the national parks. That's in its 8th edition. And I've dog-eared every edition of this book. I keep it with me. I think it used to be this book, and back when we all had to have paper atlases, right, before we carried our atlases around on our phones,
right.
I would get the Rand McNally Road Atlas every year and a dog year every page. And this book I have just used faithfully throughout the years in all my travels to the national parks.
Yeah, well, this is a whole updated version. I have to tell you, I had a friend come around and the book was on my desk and she said, can I borrow it? And I was like, no, go get your own. I thought I might never see it again. I know her well. But these are special books because you're celebrating 100 years of National Park Service. And I didn't quite understand the connection between National Geographic and national parks until, of course, I read the book. And the guide, there's a very deep legacy between National Geographic and national parks. Would you share that with our listeners?
We've been enthusiasts of the park since before there even was a National Park Service. Of course, we've been sending people out into the world since 1888 to go see new things about the world, document them, come back and share them through talks, through the pages of our magazines, through our books, and through now, TV, video, interactive media, all the rest. That's what we've been doing forever, but the places we love to get back to again and again are many of the places that become national parks in this country. In the early days of the national parks, before there was a National Park Service, there was very little protection for the parks. It was kind of piecemeal. The Army had moved in to prevent poachers from taking wildlife in the parks, people from setting up impromptu roads and hotels where they had no permits and disturbing the natural features, travelers, visitors from collecting things like going into caves and knocking off stalactites and stalagmites and taking them home. There really was no protection, and a visionary guy named Stephen Mather, who came up with the notion of 20 mule team borax. He was a brilliant marketer, and he worked in the desert Southwest mining, made a fortune doing it. But he fell in love with nature. He fell in love with these wild places, and he thought, we really need a federal agency to look after the parks. And he invited a group of people he thought could be very influential in helping build the case and support the cause. One of them was a fellow named Gil Grosvenor. He was the editor of National Geographic magazine for more than 50 years. He was the president of the Geographic for many of those years. Very influential, the most influential figure, really, in our history. Grosvenor went out to the California redwoods and the Sequoia Sequoias of the Sierra Nevada, what was called the Mather Mountain Party. They camped out for several days, and they all basically drank the Kool-Aid, came back charged up to do whatever he could, and put the whole resources of the organization behind this effort to create a National Park Service, produced an issue of the magazine, April 1916, 100 years ago this month, called The Land of the Best. It was all devoted to celebrating the wonders of our country, and we made sure that everybody in Congress and the president all had copies of that issue. And then we helped draft the legislation, the Organic Act, that would create the National Park Service. We lent some talent to help with that effort. And later that year, it came to pass. Stephen Mather himself became the first director of the Park Service. Didn't take a dime to do it. In fact, he had to fund a lot of the people who worked on his staff in the early years. And we bought a grove of redwood trees and donated them to expand Sequoia National Park.
Wow, it's pretty amazing. So it was Woodrow Wilson, I believe, who actually signed the act and put the National Park Service into place there 100 years ago.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah. Thank goodness for people with passion and vision. Otherwise, we might not have these now. They might all be flattened and bulldozed.
Well, it's true, and it's one of the wonderful things. As you learn the history of the parks, one of the most fascinating things, one of the most impressive things to me is how much a handful of individuals made a difference. You know, whether you're talking about John Muir out in Yosemite National Park, who then became a crusader working to create national parks in the very early days, or Teddy Roosevelt, or John D. Rockefeller Jr., whose dad had made a fortune. And he inherited much of that fortune, but he also inherited a passion to do something good for the public and to save these natural places. He was instrumental in creating parks like Grand Teton National Park, greatly expanded because he bought a lot of land in Jackson Hole, the Jackson Valley, right next to the Big Mountains, and Acadia National Park and elsewhere. Just a handful of people who are really committed have been responsible for preserving parks that otherwise might have become land that was used for industrial purposes, commercial purposes, parceled out and sold. And that's continued right through the history of the parks. You look south of Miami, there's Biscayne National Park and Elliott Key. These are places that just a couple of people, a handful of motivated people, stood up and said, you know, we've got lots of wonderfully developed Florida shoreline. We don't have many natural places left. Let's protect this little tiny stretch, this wonderful stretch south of Miami. And so now you have a beautiful national park just a stone's throw from Miami Beach.
Yeah, that's awesome. So there are people, you know, every year when we go through budget cuts in the government, we hear about, you know, they're going to cut back. I remember when my brother came over from England, the parks were closed, and I was most upset because he was like scheduled to come out, and we'd planned this beautiful park trip, but then fortunately they opened up in time because this was all because of budget cuts. What do you say to people who are in favor of those budget cuts and say that it's a waste of money?
Well, I think you really have to look hard at the parks. One, if you spend some time in them, you begin to appreciate their value. I mean, the parks aren't just sanctuaries. Many people think, oh, this is for the animals, you know, nature. What about mining interests? What about timber interests? What about jobs? Well, first, the parks are sanctuaries not just for wildlife. They're sanctuaries for us. I mean, as our world continues to become more urban and faster paced, and we put in more roads, more buildings, nature is only going to become more and more of a precious commodity. That ability to retreat into the sanctuary of nature and find the kind of peace of mind and connectedness you get when you're in it. So that's a value in its own right, and it's one that if you've been to the parks and spent time there alone or with your family, you really understand. What's more, the parks are an incredible investment economically. Look at, for instance, Yellowstone National Park. I mean, here's a place where 21 years ago the wolves were extinct, and there was a big debate, should we reintroduce wolves or not reintroduce wolves? Ranchers were concerned they'd come out of the park, kill their livestock, understandably, right? That's their bread and butter. Mm-hmm. And many advocates of the wolves and nature in the park said, you know, have to restore them to Yellowstone. They were eradicated by us, and we have to bring them back in to restore the balance of nature so that the park really functions the way it's supposed to function, because all the prey was sort of like, you know, their numbers were growing out of control because the alpha predator was missing. So the wolves were brought back in. Now they're thriving, and a fortune's being made by visionary people who are working in the park now, leading safaris, just like you would in Africa, leading wildlife safaris into what's been called America's Serengeti to go and see those wolves. They're the highlight of any visit to the park where you're concerned about wildlife. And I was over the winter holidays. I took my family out to Yellowstone and the Tetons on a National Geographic trip. We went in, and we looked down a spotting scope of a fellow who's been watching the wolves continuously for 20 years. He told us their story. This was a thrilling moment. That's generating millions of dollars. The value of the livestock, which, again, some visionary people brokering the deal were able to cover, they said, we'll find the money to repay you for lost livestock. It's been tens of thousands, maybe a few hundred thousand dollars. But many, many millions of dollars are being made by the local economy. The parks are great business.
Right, right. And tell us why you think it's so important to engage children at a young age.
Well, the parks are only as protected as every generation chooses to make them. Yes, they've been set aside, but for instance, look at Yosemite. Yosemite was set aside first as a state park, even before there was a national park. Abraham Lincoln, in the middle of the Civil War, signed the legislation dedicating Yosemite National Park and setting it aside in perpetuity as a California state park. Only later would it become a national park. John Muir, this great naturalist, the founder of the Sierra Club, wrote eloquently and spoke passionately about this park that he loved. But a hue and cry rose in the early years of the 20th century. We need more water for the cities of the California coast. San Francisco and other cities need water. We need reservoirs. Why not dam the Hetch Hetchy Valley right in Yosemite National Park? We can make a reservoir, and we'll have water in abundance. And people like Muir said, wait, we said we'd set it aside. We said we'd protect that. Well, there was a political debate, and in the end, Muir and the conservationists lost. The Hetch Hetchy Dam was built, and a great big reservoir still sits to this day in Yosemite National Park and land that was supposedly protected. So the parks really are only as protected as every generation chooses to make them. Our kids are the ones who are going to steward these parks in the future. And if they're going to be a legacy for their children and a resource for the children to come, then it's our kids who are going to have to discover them on their own and discover the joy and the wonder of being in the parks.
And that was Ford Cochran, the Director of Programming for National Geographic Expeditions. And these are the two books, if you're looking on camera right now, these are the two books we were talking about, the Centennial Edition of National Parks Guide USA for Kids. This is a fantastic book. Oh, awesome. I could get lost in this one myself. And then, of course, the official National Geographic Guide to National Parks of the United States, and it's the 8th edition. And they've both got brand new content in, and I was flipping through them in the break while we were listening to that interview, and you could get lost in those for easily for a couple of hours, even if you're not planning a trip. All right, please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We will be right back with Steve Berry.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to gifted animal communicator and medium Darcy Pariso, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 1st, it will either be a shelter, rescue, sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday with a bunch of great interviews, or it will be a special show with the Department of Fish and Wildlife officers and their Carilion Bear Dogs in the studio. Go to MarthaNorwalk.com or Facebook to find out. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Let's see if I guess that... This just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, best-selling author Kristen Woodson Harvey's new book, Lies and Other Acts of Love, explores the lies we tell to protect our loved ones and the life-altering consequences of a hidden truth revealed. Plus, New York Times investigative journalist looks into the science, psychology, and emotional truth behind creativity and being the best we can be in smarter, faster, better. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. And I'm very pleased to welcome New York Times bestselling author Steve Berry back to the show. His latest thriller is The 14th Colony. If you're already a Steve Berry fan, you know that history is always woven through his books. He's written 10 Cotton Malone adventures, 4 standalone thrillers, and 4 short story originals. His books have been translated into 40 languages with more than 20 million printed copies in 51 countries. And again, this book is called The 14th Colony. Steve Berry, welcome.
Be back. Thank you.
Well, the whole premise of this book is what happens if the president and vice president-elect both die before taking the oath of office? And the answer, of course, is chaos.
Yeah.
So did you choose to write about politics? I know you do write about politics a lot, but was the, you know, this being current elections going on, was that at the back of your mind too?
Yeah, I got the idea for this novel about 3 years ago, and I held it for this year on purpose because I figured the presidential elections would be on everyone's mind, and so I wanted a novel that would be timely. And the 20th Amendment to the Constitution is the amendment that deals with how you succeed to the presidency after election and in the case of no election. And there is a massive flaw in our amendment, and there's also a flaw in the 1947 Presidential Succession Act, which goes along with the amendment. A huge flaw. I'll give you an example of something that's not in the book. This shows you how bad it is.
Yeah.
We all know that if the president dies and the vice president dies, the Speaker of the House becomes president. We're all taught that at school. Here's the problem. The Constitution forbids a member of Congress from being president, so you can't have both jobs. So in order to take the oath, the Speaker must first resign. When the Speaker resigns, he's not Speaker anymore.
Right.
So he can't succeed to the presidency. That's exactly how the law is written. It is not written taking anything into account to plug up that problem. That's just one example of what I'm talking about.
There's no way just for him to feed into that from that position?
Do I now ask that again?
There's no way for him to just feed into
No. What they should have done is what they did in another provision of the law. When a cabinet member succeeds to the presidency, it says in there that by taking the oath, the cabinet member is resigning simultaneously. They did not put that language in the other section. It was left out. This is a very poorly written law with a lot of flaws in it. And when the president-elect and the vice president-elect both die before taking the oath, it's a real mess, a mess of mess. So I decided to write a thriller that kind of exploits that. But also, you know, while you're getting entertained, you're going to learn a little bit about this aspect of presidential succession.
Well, let's hope you sent a copy of your book to someone in Congress so they can get this fixed.
Well, they've actually tried for 70 years. It's gone into committee many times. It has never come to a vote on the floor. For some reason, Congress just refuses to fix the law, to fix the flaws in the law. And this isn't the only one. There's about a half a dozen flaws in the law. So if we ever did get down to the point where one of these folks succeeded to the presidency, it would be quite a legal mess.
Well, why doesn't that surprise me, I wonder? So, Cotton Malone is your protagonist in this book. You've been writing about him for a long time now. Do you ever get bored with a character? He grows through each story, I'm sure. But,
he changes. So I don't get bored with him for that very reason. The Cotton Malone of the Templar Legacy, which was the very first novel, and the Cotton Malone of the 14th Colony, the latest one, is a different kind of guy. He's evolved. There's a lot going on in his life. Things are changing for him. If he stayed the same in every book, I think not only would I get bored with it, the readers would get bored with it.
Yes.
So I don't really get bored with him. I like expanding his world. I like growing him. I like him changing and evolving. My wife Elizabeth has a lot of impact into Cotton, so he has a lot more emotion than I may have given him that she likes to put into him. So it's fun.
Yeah. And so when you set out to write a new book, Steve, do you think, okay, how can I make Cotton grow this time? Or do you begin with the story and have him evolve through the story?
Well, the story most likely first. I get the thing from history. And not only must I have a thing from history, I must have it relevant still today. It still needs to be important today, just not 500 years ago or 400 years ago or 50 years ago. And then once I get that, I start figuring out, well, how can I have Cotton grow a little bit? And he's had a relationship with Cassiopeia for a while. That sort of was a growing process. They broke up at the end of two books ago. She sat out last book, but she's back this book. And so Cassiopeia is a very popular character. I got a lot of emails from readers saying, you're not getting rid of her, not getting rid of her. I knew that I was going to mess with them a little bit, but they're back together now, and I will keep them together.
Mm. Have you ever written anybody into a book or out of a book or a situation that's really upset readers? They do get vocal, and they do like to let you know, right?
Very much so. I killed one of my characters in a book in The Paris Vendetta. It was a character that had been in the first few books, and it was an integral part of Cotton's world. And I killed him in The Paris Vendetta, and I did receive a lot of emails for it. But it was something that had to be done. It was I'd done about all I could with that character. It was time for him to move on, so I could bring in some new folks.
Mm. Now, you're a history buff. You also travel a lot, do a lot of research while you're traveling. This book starts with a conversation between President Ronald Reagan and St. Pope John Paul. So tell us a little bit about this, because this actually happened, but of course we don't know the actual conversation that went on.
We don't, but it actually did happen on June the 7th, 1982, in the Vatican, the first and only time that a pope and a president have spoken alone. There was no one in the room, no notes, no agenda, no recording, and neither man ever spoke of the conversation, ever. Now, historians seem to think that what they did that day is they made an agreement among themselves that they would work independent of one another and they would bring the Soviet Union down. Now, we don't know that happened because nobody was there. But what we do know is for the next 6 years, that is exactly what both men did. And they worked very hard, and I think history credits them as being the two responsible for bringing the Soviet Union to its knees.
Yeah, interesting. So I want to ask you about the dedication to the book, Steve, for the Ducks.
Yes. You're the first interviewer of all the interviews I've done who's actually asked this.
Well, and it made me laugh because my mom used to leave me messages when she was alive saying, hey, it's Mommy Duck, is Baby Duck there? So tell us about this Baby Duck thing.
We had a trip, a Steve Berrien fans trip that we took, and we went to Prague. And we saw everything from the Columbus Affair, and then we took a riverboat cruise down the Danube and saw some more stuff from the books. We did a second trip last summer to France to see everything from the Templar legacy. I take about 30, it was 32 the first time, 42 the second time. And we take them, and we go, and we kind of retrace my steps, and I show you everything from the book and how I put it together and assembled it. It's like you get to see how the book was put together on site. And what happened was we would go out on the tours, and Elizabeth would be in front, and she'd had this big orange paddle. And I was talking to everyone in a headset. Everyone was wearing these headsets, and I was talking to them. And I just said, just follow Mama Duck. Follow Mama Duck wherever she goes. So we all became ducks as we followed her around, and so it just sort of stuck. And so now we have the original ducks who went on the first trip, and then the sophomore class of ducks. And now we're next year, we're doing the Steve Berry and Fans German cruise. We're going to go to Aachen and see everything from the Charlemagne Pursuit. Then we're going to take a cruise down the river to all the Christmas markets in Germany and go to Bamberg, which was in the Third Secret.
Wow.
So there'll be a new class of ducks. Next year we have 54 going on that trip at this point.
Wow, it sounds like a lot of fun. And these are, what, do you put it on your website?
If anyone's interested in the Christmas cruise, you can go to steveberry.org to the events section and go down, and you'll see a link that will take. There's still room on those. There's still room there if anybody would like to come. They're a lot of fun. We do a lot of interaction. We make a point to interact with everyone, and we get to know everyone. And I take them around and show them all the stuff from the novel.
Mm. You've mentioned your wife Elizabeth a couple of times. I know she's integral to the work you do. She made a couple of suggestions, as you've said, about Cotton Malone, mm-hmm. and she works with you on History Matters,
she
your
does.
Foundation that's mm-hmm. dedicated to historic preservation. I'm wondering, when you were doing the research for this book, was there something that really surprised the both of you?
Well, the invasion plans of Canada from the 1930s was a little bit of a surprise to me. I didn't, that's the title of the book's The 14th Colony. Canada was supposed to be our 14th colony, but we invaded twice and got defeated twice. But in the 1930s, we actually had a plan to invade Canada again that stayed classified until 1974. And that sort of surprised me. I didn't realize we had that. It's all part of the novel. It all works into the novel of this plot. So that was probably the most surprising thing I came across in this particular research. The flaws in the 20th Amendment are surprising, but there are other flaws in the Constitution, so those aren't as shocking. But to think that we would have actually invaded Canada, we not only had a plan, we actually took steps to implement the plan. If Hitler had taken Britain in the Battle of Britain, we would have invaded Canada. That's exactly what would have happened, but of course that never came to pass.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's always interesting to find out these little known facts.
Yeah, I was shocked. It's a very intricate plan. A lot of it's quoted in the novel. I mean, we went to a lot of trouble to get ready to do that.
Right. So we gave an introduction to Cotton, but tell us the high-level premise of the book beyond this question of, what happens if they both die?
Well, it's a ticking clock down to January 20th at 12 noon. It's about a 42-hour adventure that Cotton gets caught up in, and he gets caught up in from the Cold War. There's an old KGB agent who's been stewing for 25 years. His whole world was destroyed when the Soviet Union fell. His whole life was just completely upended, and he's been stewing on this for a long time. And he's decided to give America a dose of the same chaos that we gave to the Soviet Union. And he's going to use some things from the Cold War, some real things that I came across that were very surprising, too, that I was shocked to find out about. And he's going to try to hurt us, to take a strike to us. I based him on some real ex-KGB agents. I've read books about them and books by them and read some of their feelings and thoughts. So he's sort of a composite of a bunch of those. And this is a really interesting ticking clock down to that moment at 12 noon, where the reader's going to have a lot of fun in the adventure, but you're also going to learn some things about the Constitution and the Cold War and Canada that you may never have known.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Steve Berry, always a pleasure talking with you. I know listeners can find out more about you at your website, steveberry.org. A final quick thought you'd like to leave them with today.
I just hope they go out and check out the book and enjoy it. It's doing very well. It was number 5 on the Times list last week, 2 weeks ago, and number 9 this week. So it's doing good.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank
Appreciate
you,
it.
Bye-bye.
And again, that was Steve Berry, his book, The 14th Colony. You can find out more about Steve and his work at steveberry.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617. If you have questions or want websites or, information about any of our guests, I'm happy to always forward that on. You can also find me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. parkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonsparkinsonspar We are at Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I want to thank each of you for tuning in and spending this hour with us today. Appreciate your time. Until next week, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.